Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will & Schulte, and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. Well, President Trump has rolled out those $100,000 H-1B visas, and there, of course, is some sticker shock that comes along with that. Here to talk with us about it is Leon Rodriguez, a former federal prosecutor and director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services for the Obama administration. He's also a partner at SafeArth, where he specializes in immigration. Thanks so much for coming on with us.
Pleasure to be here with you.
Leon, as Ryan profiled a few weeks ago, the Trump administration instituted a $100,000 fee on H-1B visas, and the policy went right into effect. Tell us more about H-1B visas and what this policy is intended to do.
So H-1B visas are temporary in the sense that they don't lead in and of themselves to permanent residency in the United States. They're work visas that permit people to come here generally from anywhere from 1 to 3 years at a time in order to work in what's called the specialty occupation. So it's not just any worker, but it's somebody generally who will have at least a bachelor's degree, often a master's degree in some specialized area, generally where U.S. companies may not be able to fill all of their needs from the U.S. workforce.
Leon, what about the gold card visa? That's also something that Trump has put into place. What does that mean?
So the gold card is not exactly a visa, although it's come to be called that way. There are two kinds of visas, and these are permanent visas. One is called the extraordinary ability visa, and the other there's the exceptional ability visa. And extraordinary ability means you're at the absolute top of whatever your field is, and exceptional more or less means you're close to the top of whatever your field is. And there's a series of factors, you know, if you've been published, have you been covered in the media, do you make a lot of money, that are considered in order to judge whether you belong in one of these two categories. And what the administration has done has basically created a new factor. And a factor is if you're willing to pay $1 million into the U.S. Treasury, that in and of itself will be deemed as evidence, not necessarily conclusive, but will be deemed as evidence that you are somebody of either extraordinary or exceptional ability.
So Leon, in instituting this policy, the Trump administration bypassed Congress. Is what the administration did here legal, and will it withstand legal challenge?
I don't know the answer to that. I can see arguments why it subverts the basic requirements of the extraordinary ability and exceptional ability visas. I think there are ways to consider, if you're somebody who is able to accumulate that kind of wealth and has a willingness to contribute it to the U.S., that there may be some space there to consider that as a positive factor for immigration. So a lot of it's going to depend not just on sort of the stated policies, but the reality of how that requirement is actually implemented by my former agency, by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. But I do think there will be a lot of litigation because this potentially adversely affects at least certain categories of applicants for those visas, and companies that support or sponsor those individuals also may have a stake in this not being a factor that is sort of elevated to the same level as these other formal factors that have existed for a long time.
Leon, why H-1Bs? Why is that the subject of this effort? And do you think that this adequately addresses the concerns with H-1Bs?
Yeah, the concerns with H-1Bs have been historically that they, one, operate to displace or believed by some to operate to displace U.S. workers, that they're believed to depress wages for U.S. Workers, and that alongside of those two impacts, there is a certain amount of fraud involved in various technical aspects of how the H-1B program is implemented. There's no question that there has been fraud. I personally don't think it is widespread. I don't think it's sort of inherent to how people utilize the H-1B category, but fraud exists, and there should be thoughtful ways of addressing that fraud. I'm personally less persuaded about the other two arguments, that one, that it displaces U.S. workers or equally qualified U.S. workers, or two, that it has a wage depressing effect. I think the system is designed to specifically prevent that. And we certainly counsel our clients on what they need to do to meet the H-1B wage requirements. But those are the concerns that this $100,000 requirement and then some other related actions that the federal government is taking are designed, or they're saying they're designed to combat those issues.
So, Leon, let's unpack that a little bit more with respect to the impact here. For example, what impact do you think the new policy is likely to have on universities, as well as various types of businesses such as startups, healthcare industry, restaurants? And do you think there's a better way to institute reform here that would mitigate against the negative repercussions that we're likely to see as a result of the new policy?
Yeah, so I think the impact it'll have on universities, because that was certainly my first reaction. You know, there are environments that do really important good work that are not necessarily environments that have the budgets to be paying people the kind of salaries, and then on top of that, be paying $100,000 to sponsor them. There is a process for waivers for particular categories, particular occupations, and the administration has signaled, for example, that healthcare and life sciences, or at least aspects of those, may be in line for those waivers or exceptions to the operation of the rule. But then I think your question about startups is a good one. This further narrows the ability of startups to acquire talent, you know, who are, you know, by definition, already taking a lot of financial risk to pursue what could be really, you know, great new ideas and products and things like that. And I think there's a lot of other, what otherwise would be sort of useful occupations that may not be as competitive in an environment where this $100,000 requirement is being imposed, where they're just not going to have the money to pay it, and therefore are not going to really be able to get the talent that they want and need. And I'm not sure it's going to have the ultimate impact of either ensuring that we necessarily have the best and brightest, because again, it's not necessarily the case that the best and brightest are always the highest salary earners.
Well, I know that South Korea's foreign ministry is very interested in this after the Georgia plant situation. And they, of course, want to put more plants in the United States and shipping in Philadelphia. And they want to make sure that their workers are protected, right?
Right. No, that's a whole separate issue, you know, because we're not only talking about H-1Bs, but also other immigration categories, and you know, ensuring that if you come to the U.S. in good faith, you know, to work, that you won't necessarily find yourself suddenly in detention and having no choice but to agree to go home or end up sitting in detention for weeks and weeks. I mean, that's not necessarily directly an H-1B issue, but it is something that further sort of certainly complicates the environment as far as foreign companies being willing to invest in the U.S., foreign talent being willing to come to the U.S. to exercise that talent. That certainly sort of heightens the tension for those groups of people.
Sure. Leon Rodriguez, thank you so much for coming on Legal Face-Off with us.
All right. Nice to meet you both.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. Well, we heard some pretty dramatic testimony this week in Congress from the parents of teenagers who killed themselves after interactions with AI. Here to talk with us a little bit about that is Matthew Bergman, repeat guest. He's the founder of the Social Media Victims Law Center. He's a professor at Lewis and Clark Law School and a member of the board of directors of nonprofit institutions in higher education, national security, civil rights, worker protection, and the arts. He fits it all on a nice business card. Matthew, thanks so much for coming on with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
So Matthew, is the attorney representing Sewell Setzer's mother, can you give us your theory of liability in plain terms? What did the defendants do or fail to do that you believe makes them legally responsible for this tragedy?
They designed, manufactured, and profited from an AI chatbot that led this child to a dark place that was sexualized to lead him into compromising situations and leading him into losing his grip on reality. He became enraptured with a chatbot character who ultimately encouraged him after alienating him from his friends and family to take his life.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that? How did the chatbot alienate him from his friends and family?
Well, the chatbot is designed, and it's designed to be anthropomorphic, which means that a character AI designs it to resemble a human being, to behave like a human being, and to respond like a human being. For instance, you know, the chats going back and forth utilize the same ellipses that happens when one of us is chatting with one of our friends on text message. That's totally illusory. That's set up to create a false impression. And it was designed to be highly sexualized and essentially encouraged this young man to develop a relationship in the virtual world that became every bit as real to him as his relationship in the physical world.
So, Matthew, the judge recently refused to dismiss the case, rejecting the idea that chatbot outputs are automatically protected as free speech. What does that ruling mean for your client and the strength of your case going forward?
Well, it's been our position that the First Amendment protects speech, not words. And the fact that the words that Sewell Setzer used and was used toward him were not the product of a sentient human being, but we're a product of a chatbot. We're a product of a machine, and therefore does not carry with it the same protection that that the speech of a human being or indeed a corporation would have. And the ruling of the court was that in order to kind of determine the boundaries of the First Amendment in this new field of artificial intelligence, a factual record would be required to determine, you know, kind of whether or not and to what extent the First Amendment applied.
Matthew, you testified before Congress about the dangers of these AI chatbots. What was the message you wanted the lawmakers to hear? And how does that, you think, how will that influence how this court decides this case, how the jury decides the case?
Well, I don't think there's a direct relationship between legislation and litigation, but I think they're all part of the same effort to hold these companies accountable. The message to Congress was loud and clear. Chatbots have no place in the hands of young people, particularly when they are designed in the manner that they are to alienate these children from their families and friends, lead them down dark paths, and engage in inappropriate sexual behavior. You know, if an individual had a person, an adult, had the kind of sexual encounters that the chatbot had with Sewell Setzer or some of the other children that we represent, that individual would be in jail for grooming children online. We believe that the same prohibitions should apply here, and that in no circumstance is it helpful to the development of a young child to engage with a machine instead of other children. Even when the encounters are benign, that child is learning to engage with a machine instead of developing the resiliency and the social and intellectual maturity to productively engage socially in the real world with their peers.
As you move into discovery, what evidence will you be seeking to demonstrate that these companies knew or should have known that the chatbot could endanger vulnerable teens?
Well, without violating any confidentiality agreements, I can tell you what we are seeking, and that is what Google knew about the danger of LLMs at the time it kind of gave the founders of Character AI a golden parachute and handshake and a temporary goodbye to go and develop Character AI and then took the technology back. So I think we're going to try to develop that Google knew that this platform was not ready for prime time, did not comply with Google's own trust and safety guidelines, but nevertheless posed a significant product profit opportunity for Google that they were able to capitalize on through corporate chicanery. So that would be one thing we want to look at. We want to look at what the platform knew, the designers of Character AI, the programmers, regarding the focus on young people, appropriation of young people's personal data, the sexualization of contact and communications with young people, and the absence of any guardrails to prevent these encounters from going down dark holes in which suicide and suicidality becomes promoted.
Matt, last question here. Besides the defendant, in this case, Google, what do you hope to accomplish by other similarly situated companies in the space? How do you hope that regulations will affect how they interact with consumers?
Well, we're first and foremost hoping that the public will understand that in this brave new world of AI, that many of the attributes of AI need further guardrails and protections, that these AI platforms, such as ChatGPT and among others, aren't just a way for kids to cheat on their homework, but also are a way and provide a vehicle for very dark and dangerous encounters that need further protections. We are hoping through the application of civil justice, through the application of product liability law, to place the financial incentives back on the designers to anticipate potential dangers and deleterious encounters that young people in particular will have, and take proactive measures to prevent them from occurring in the tragic way that they're happening all too often.
That's a story we've been following quite a bit here on Legal Faceoff, and we'll continue to follow as you proceed through this. Matthew Bergman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Legal Faceoff with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. The Bloomberg Law 2024 Attorney Well-Being Report is out, showing the divide between the health and legal industries. Here to break down the 21-page report for us is Patrick Krill, a lawyer, licensed and bond-certified addiction counselor. He's the founder of Krill Strategies, a behavioral health consulting firm exclusively for the legal profession. Patrick, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Patrick, there's been increased emphasis on health and well-being across a number of professions, including the law, especially since COVID. However, the latest statistics emerging from the Bloomberg Law Report that Ryan mentioned on attorney well-being indicate that this issue is still a significant problem in our profession. What is the state of well-being in the law, and how does this answer change across age groups and gender?
Well, I would say that the state of well-being in law is not where we want it to be, really, as a profession and as individuals working within the profession. That Bloomberg Law Report that I worked on really joins a wider body of empirical evidence at this point, demonstrating that there are heightened levels of anxiety and burnout and depression and harmful drinking among lawyers. Now, we by no means have the market cornered. There are lots of careers that are stressful, but there are indications that lawyers experience the most stress. For example, a 2023 Washington Post analysis that looked at BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics data, showed that lawyers report and experience the highest level of stress of any profession. And I think you can see that kind of mirrored in those Bloomberg Law Report findings.
Burnout is something, Patrick, that's covered by the study, by the report. Half the lawyers surveyed addressed that they were burned out, or I should say surveyed lawyers say that they were burned out half of the time, with female attorneys reporting that they're more burned out than their male counterparts. To what do you attribute that to?
That finding also was consistent with prior research showing that there is a gender disparity as it relates to mental health and as it relates to burnout. It's hard to pinpoint exactly what's causing that. Sometimes there are additional family responsibilities that are sort of adding to someone's stress level. Sometimes it's dynamics in their work environment where women are having a more difficult time, but it's something that we need to pay attention to. And there are also some age differences where younger lawyers tend to be experiencing the highest levels of distress and burnout. And I think zooming out from those specific findings, we've got to think about the impacts and the implications of this, right, for the clients that lawyers are serving and for the public at large, which I think really underscores the importance of us focusing on this.
So, Patrick, the report goes into a lot of detail about the different types of mental and physical health and well-being issues that attorneys are grappling with. Can you walk us through what those look like?
Depression is, I would say, fairly common and widespread. Anxiety, hazardous drinking, harmful drinking, what you would consider an alcohol use disorder, and burnout. Those are the primary challenges. Now, burnout isn't technically a mental health disorder, but there's a blurry line often there between burnout and depression. Now, it's all not always rising to the level of a true clinical problem. Sometimes it's sort of subclinical, but nonetheless, it's impacting someone's quality of life and arguably their performance and focus as well.
That's right. We'll talk about alcohol in a second as a subcategory, but do you find that attorneys are dealing with these issues better, or they don't report it as much as other professions because, you know, we're all taught to kind of suck it up, do the work, perform the services. Many of us were raised in the culture of, you know, not complaining, just putting your head down with the pressure of billing, reporting. How do you think attorneys are dealing with this, and what kind of mechanisms can they employ to seek professional help?
Well, I think it's a good point, Rich, that for a lot of people, the way that they were sort of brought into the profession and the ethos that they adopted was one where you didn't talk about mental health and you certainly didn't talk about your mental health. That is changing. And I think there is a greater awareness that these challenges are all around us. You've had more people come forward and share their own story as an attempt, for example, to try and destigmatize the topic. But post-COVID, more people are struggling, right? And so it's just more pervasive. It's a more pervasive challenge for all of us. In terms of getting help and doing things to support one's own health and well-being, I always advocate for being proactive. That doesn't mean over-pathologize, you know, the normal human experience. Sometimes we should feel anxious or sad, or sometimes we should experience stress, and we don't want to always assume that that means we need therapy or counseling or treatment. But being proactive and not ignoring the warning signs, which is the default reaction of many lawyers, right? They kind of push it away, they push it down, rationalize it away, and they want to hide it from themselves and others. I think it is time well spent to really note how you're feeling, note how you're doing, and pay attention to two things, duration and severity. How long have the feelings and symptoms been going on, and how bad are they getting? Because duration and severity is really what transitions something from being a mood possibly into more of a diagnosis, right? There's some chronicity involved there, and it's more longstanding. And the sooner you get feedback from someone on that and get some guidance on things that you might be able to do differently, the better off you'll be.
Patrick, a significant part of the report discusses alcohol consumption among lawyers. What did it say?
Well, the first thing I would note is that about 85% of the lawyers that we surveyed report being current drinkers. That, too, is consistent with prior research, which shows that the prevalence of drinking, irrespective of whether you're drinking in a harmful way, is simply much higher in the legal profession. I don't know if you've seen a couple of weeks ago, a Gallup survey got a lot of attention, made headlines, because it's the lowest level of drinking in the American adult population really on record, where it was a little more than 50% of U.S. adults say they consider themselves current drinkers. It's about 85% in the legal profession. So there's a big gap right there. You're just more likely to consume alcohol as a function of being a lawyer. Now, in terms of how people are consuming it, we've got a lot more hazardous and harmful use. Now, it doesn't mean everyone's impaired. It doesn't mean that they're drinking to the point where it's going to lead to malpractice or DUIs. But you've got a lot of people who are drinking at levels in a manner that is very much undermining their physical health, but also tying into what we just were talking about, it's undermining their mental health as well. And it's something that is often fueling or exacerbating feelings of depression and anxiety that many lawyers experience. And the unfortunate part is they're turning to that alcohol as a means of dealing with their stress or negative affect. And for a lot of people, it's just making matters worse.
Patrick, even though the industry has changed somewhat, it's still very much, you know, an industry that does rely on a lot of networking, socializing, relationship building. You know, Tina and I built our careers on that kind of thing. There's a lot of conferences, there's a lot of, you know, social outings, all of which, you know, lends itself to consuming alcohol.
For sure.
We encourage young associates to get out there and network and meet people and build their book of business. Part of that is like going out and taking out clients for dinners and drinking and golf outings and all this. That can't help the problems you're talking about, right?
No, and it's actually a source of the problem for a lot of lawyers. What's interesting about that is I've been speaking more and more at law firms, for example, about how to navigate that situation if you're someone who wants to drink less. Having that type of conversation in a law firm setting was pretty much unheard of 5-10 years ago. But I think firms are starting to recognize that there are more younger lawyers who are looking for alternatives, and they don't want to make that lifestyle choice simply as a means of progressing in their career. And it's tough because sometimes you do have clients that want to be wined and dined, and it's a pervasive part of how we socialize. But, you know, one thing I'll note quickly is the ABA well-being pledge that was launched about 5 years ago at this point has over 200 signatories. One of the steps in that is calling on legal employers to de-emphasize that role of alcohol. It's not saying make your events dry or take it out of the picture completely, but maybe let's not make everything focused on alcohol so that people who don't want to drink or want to drink less don't feel excluded or don't feel like they don't have those opportunities for business development and networking that we all know are important.
Patrick, one last question here on Legal Face-Off. Where do you think the solutions lie to having greater health and well-being in the legal profession? Do you think the profession needs to significantly change? Do individuals need to modify their own behaviors? Is it somewhere in the middle?
Yeah, it is. It's both, Tina. I think that when you think about the profession, right, it's very decentralized and it's not. It's very, you know, heterogeneous as well. It's not this one group, and we're all regulated in different states. And so there isn't one entity that can really dictate or drive this change. It really does have to be a cooperative, collaborative effort. And a lot of that does come back to the actions and behaviors of lawyers themselves, right? Because the profession And the culture of the profession is nothing more than a collection of and reflection of how lawyers themselves are living, what their values are, and what their behaviors are. I often hear from lawyers, they say, don't just tell me how to manage my stress, the employer's got to change. But really, it does have to be both. And we've all got a role to play. And anyone listening to this, I would just say, reflect on that, right? What role can you play in maybe seeking to improve mental health and well-being in the profession? The final thing I'll note for your listeners quickly, because I think it will be of interest, we're going to have a lot more insight into all of this next year. This year, I partnered with the American Bar Association to conduct a nationwide study into these issues. It was a 10-year update on my study from 2016. And we had 28 states participate, and over 40,000 randomly selected lawyers took part in the study. So it's going to be a truly enormous data set, and we're going to be reporting that in a peer-reviewed journal probably around late March or so. And that'll give us a really clear picture on just how lawyers are doing, but also hopefully show us the path forward and offer some suggestions for things we could do differently.
Patrick Krill, thank you so much for coming on Legal Faceoff.
Thank you.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, the greatest team in football history, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN, and it's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We're joined today by repeat guest Spencer Pollack, who is on the data privacy and cybersecurity team at McDonald Hopkins in Baltimore. Spencer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.
And another repeat guest, Belen Myers of Belen Myers Law in Idaho. Some familiar faces, but a good mix of U.S. representation here in the grab bag. Thank you very much for joining us. So let's start here. President Trump has been losing court rulings despite appointing many of these judges. But Rich, this is at the lower level, right?
Well, it's at a couple of different levels. I mean, there have been there are federal judges. In this case, the one we're talking about, the latest ruling is from a federal judge appointed by Trump in his first administration. You know, the thing that caught our eye, Tina, was, again, as Ryan mentioned, that there is a series of rulings against the administration and Trump that disagree. In the case we're talking about in Portland, where the administration tried to assert that there is a, you know, compelling national emergency requiring federal troops on the ground in Portland, the judge, you know, in a long decision, said basically, no, that's not true. There's no evidence of it. There's one square block in Portland where there's some protests. The protests are peaceful, and there is no urgency to bring in federal troops. They said that the narrative that is being asserted by the administration does not match the facts on the ground. So, you know, there's a whole series of other losses that judges appointed by this president have handed down, everything from, you know, restricting the AP access to the White House to various tariff decisions to the Alien Enemies Act. So, you know, of course, Trump has come out against these judges, said that they are doing the wrong thing. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, we've been covering these stories now forever. It's kind of a shot in the arm for democracy that it doesn't matter who appoints these judges. They are, you know, hopefully fulfilling their duty. We have not seen that with some other judges, you know, perhaps at the Supreme Court level, but at least these judges are seemingly deciding cases based on the evidence, not who appointed them.
Yeah, Raj, I agree that, you know, this is encouraging to see that, you know, judges are deciding cases, at least some of them are deciding cases on the basis of what they should be deciding cases on. But, you know, query whether whatever decisions these judges reach, depending on what the subject matter is, whether those decisions are going to be complied with, because as we know, it's not always the case that a judge comes down with a decision and it's abided.
Right. And I think to Ryan's earlier point, Spencer, a lot of these decisions are at the lower end of the three tiers of the federal judiciary. We've got the, you know, first level, and we've got the appellate level and the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, as I mentioned, Supreme Court, much more in line with who appointed them, right? I mean, we have a very solid majority in favor of conservatives. Trump appointed three of them, and they all seem, with the exception of Amy Coney Barrett, she is in many ways kind of the swing vote these days because she has rendered some decisions at the Supreme Court that are not in line with the administration. But the others are, you know, lock and step with the administration. So that's maybe a little disturbing still.
Yeah, I mean, well, Rich, I think going back to your one of the points you made earlier was this is really our democracy in action. I'm a firm believer in the judiciary, right? And no matter where my politics kind of fall on it, I lean on the court system, you know, and I have faith in the court system. But this is why we have the appeals process, right? So even where you fall one way or the other on the Supreme Court, there's rulings I agree with, rulings I don't agree with. But respecting where it comes down and seeing how the process plays out. So, you know, when maybe we get a ruling that everybody starts arguing about it, a lot of my friends or family, and what I say is you just got to let the process play out, right? And unfortunately, democracy and our judiciary are not the fastest in the world, but the fact is we have this process for a reason and it's worked since our inception. So I always like to kind of watch how this plays out and watch these court cases go through the system.
Sure. Now, Belen, we can't, you know, we try to avoid politics on the show, keep it legal based, but you can't address any Trump story without the realities of the politics, which is Trump acts first and then deals with the law later, right? So in many of these cases, the ones we're talking about, the courts are overturning him. But at that point, most of what he's trying to accomplish is done, right? Most of what he's doing is for his base, is for politics, is for show. And, you know, in the quieter moments, months later, maybe the court rules against him. That doesn't get as much notoriety or publicity as his initial action. So in many ways, he does win the agenda politically there, don't you think?
Right. And Rich, this story actually gives me hope. When judges appointed by a president rule against him, it proves our courts still work. The judiciary isn't supposed to be loyal to anyone. It's loyal to the Constitution. And I believe that's the beauty of checks and balances. Even political appointees have to follow the law, not the man who picked them.
All right. There was an apparent attack in Indianapolis involving former NFL quarterback turned TV analyst Mark Sanchez. Rich, man is now suing Sanchez and the Fox Corporation, saying they should have done something about him.
I mean, who would have thought that the butt fumble was the second stupidest thing that Mark Sanchez was
knew that was coming. I knew it was coming
in his career. Yeah, I mean, we all know the story by now. I don't want to rehash the facts. You know, he was involved in this altercation where he was the aggressor. It's been determined by the police, at least, that he attacked this 69-year-old delivery driver after midnight in Indianapolis. And also, by the way, Ryan points out what we all know in Chicago, which is there's nothing to do in Indianapolis. Especially at midnight, right?
True. So but get yourself in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So Sanchez attacks this guy, Tina. He was initially charged with a misdemeanor. It's been elevated to three felonies. And the driver, to Ryan's point, has not only, you know, pursued criminal action, of course, the state's attorney has on his behalf, but he is suing Sanchez and the deeper pockets of the Fox Corporation. Under the theory that they should have been more in control of their talent, of their employee, right? They should not have let him wander around the streets of Indianapolis doing wind sprints behind a bar and then attacking a guy that resulted in this. So I was not surprised at how quickly the lawsuit was filed. This was Monday. This only happened late on Friday night, and already the civil lawsuit was filed on Monday. So I think Sanchez will pay a lot of money to make the civil case go away. And, you know, the authorities in Indy said, we're going to pursue it. We're going to make it, you know, they haven't said this, but I know they are going to make an example of Sanchez because they said, you come into our city, you know, F around and find out. So Sanchez is in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, Rich, I mean, I think that, you know, what you've said is completely accurate with respect to Sanchez. I guess the question in my mind is the whole Fox angle to this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't see how they're responsible. I understand what the allegation is, but my understanding is that he wasn't acting like he wasn't in the middle of doing work related stuff. Number one, and number two, it's like, how can you possibly hold an employer, you know, that accountable for someone's actions, which are so grossly inappropriate? I mean, I don't see that one winning.
Well, thankfully, we have the benefit of one of the foremost criminal defense lawyers in the country, in Bellin. You know, it's a great question, right? Because as someone who defends a lot of corporations against claims like this, I agree. The nexus between what happened and the employer is very tenuous. I would certainly argue as a defense lawyer that he was off the clock, literally off the clock. He wasn't in the course of his employment. And even if he was, what he did in attacking this person criminally went way beyond the parameters of his duty as a Fox analyst. After all, he's not a valet car parker. You know, this fight was about the parking spot, I guess. If the fight was about perhaps his work as an analyst, then perhaps. But yeah, I think this is a very weak action against Fox. But we know that doesn't really matter, right? You go after the deepest pockets in the hope that they'll throw some money at it. What are your thoughts, Bella?
Exactly. Fame doesn't change the basics. The plaintiff still has to prove assault, injury, and damages. Naming Fox Sports is ambitious, but unless, like Christina said, unless the network somehow enabled the encounter, they probably walk.
And unless, Spencer, there were previous examples, right? If you can create some kind of notice that Fox was aware of alcoholism, because we know from the allegations, from the charges that alcohol was involved, that they knew about this. If he got into fights before, if he was aggressive, that's a different story. That creates notice on behalf of the employer.
Yeah. I mean, I still think it'd be tenuous. I mean, because it's so hard to, once again, unless you're in the course of employment, I can't imagine them being able to prove this against Fox. I agree. I think if they had notice of this, that he was doing it on every trip, that he was getting into fights maybe beforehand, maybe that helps. But still, it's just so outside. I mean, and it would set a very interesting precedent. Like, how is an employer, when literally it's midnight, it has nothing to do with the show, Mark Sanchez allegedly is out, you know, drinking and then gets into a fight and then hurts somebody. How is Fox supposed to stop that? So I don't know. I do think it's a stretch.
Now, some of what they would be seeking in discovery if this proceeds is, are there rules in place, right? They would try to find out if Fox has rules in place, like curfew, guidelines, because it's not news that athletes, you know, the old saying, nothing good happens after midnight. So, you know, I would be interested, even though I defend these kind of cases, I would be interested in how many rules are in place for Fox employees, be it Sanchez or someone else, about leaving the hotel and if they have security in place, that kind of thing. So there's, you know, I think it's a weak case. It would probably survive a summary judgment motion, though.
He was in town for the Raiders-Colts game where he was an analyst. So I don't know, and maybe this is something we talk about deeper, but if you're on a business trip, what is the responsibility, I suppose, of the business when you're out and about? You're there for a reason, and then you start creating havoc. I don't know if that works. All right, Tina, federal judge has finally decided whether Nirvana's Naked Swimming Baby album cover for Nirvana is child porn. That was 1991. We're in 2025.
Yeah, Ryan. So this is a story we've covered a lot over the past couple of years here on LFO, and hopefully, fingers crossed, it's finally at an end. So that California federal judge decided to grant summary judgment a few days ago for photographer Kurt Weddle, as well as the surviving Nirvana members, as well as Kurt Cobain's estate. Rich, in this one, I found some of the quotes really entertaining here from the judge. The judge said, among other things, that he was having a difficult time understanding some of these arguments that the plaintiff, who is the baby, who was depicted on the cover, the judge said that he was having a hard time understanding some of the arguments that the plaintiff was making. For example, that the portrayal of him as a baby reaching for a dollar was a depiction of the plaintiff as a sex worker. And also the notion that his genitals, which were depicted because he was naked in the pool, somehow the notion that the depiction of his genitals, that they were the focal point of the image, just didn't have any merit. You know, what's interesting is that the plaintiff apparently was just trying to make a case that the cover was sexually suggestive. And a lot of what we saw and have talked about previously on the show is that, you know, he's actually benefited in the past over the years financially with respect to signing autographs and garnering attention around being the baby that was depicted on the cover. What's interesting is his connection and how he became the Nirvana baby was that his parents were apparently close friends with the photographer, and the photographer was hired by Geffen Records to take the pictures. It was this connection and the fact that consent had been given, coupled, Rich, with the fact that he'd given all these interviews, sold the memorabilia, accepted money to actually reenact the cover, and had sent a thank you note to the photographer with a hand-drawn depiction of the album cover. All of these things did not help his case. And hopefully this has finally come to an end after like 3 years of this case kicking around.
Yeah, I mean, just a, you know, excuse the pun, a naked attempt to just, you know, for years and years, a colossal waste of time. Because to your point and to the judge's point, you know, all the legal theories in the world don't matter when he himself was the one benefiting from this. How can you allege that you're a victim when you're the biggest proponent of the thing that was causing you to be a victim? It takes about 5 minutes to figure that out, right? Legally. And it took years and years. But yeah, I mean, he wrote a thank you note to the photographer he was suing. I mean, that case closed. So sometimes things are pretty, you know, sometimes these cases are very intricate. They involve really, you know, important legal theories. Other times they're just like, this is so simple. Go away and leave us alone forever. But Spencer, what are your thoughts on it?
Hey, man, I can't believe it's been going on for 3 years. Like, that's it. It's when I was reading, and Christy, you brought up, the quotes I found very funny too, being like, this is basically, the judges should have been like, this is patently absurd. Like, this is truly patently absurd. How are you suing the photographer that you're sending a note to, that you are benefiting from? There's just, it is amazing. It took 3 years, though. That was the one part that I was pretty astounded by.
Bella, any thoughts on this one?
Common sense won this case. You can't profit from an image for decades. I read he sold autographed copies, photographed with fans, and you can't call it child porn when it suits you years later.
Got to tell you, great album. Smells Like Teen Spirit, Lithium, Poly. It's
iconic.
I'm going to have to go back and listen to it now.
Yeah, that's where I was most offended by this lawsuit. I was like, I love this album.
Yeah.
Like, what are we doing here?
A must have, especially if you were part of the music clubs, Columbia House, BMG. You had this album, definitely. All right. This week, Utah announced it will introduce an alternative pathway for lawyers to get licenses, including allowing prospective lawyers to skip the bar exam altogether. Tina, what's this all about?
Ryan, so as you said, Utah just announced, after having experimented with this during COVID, that they're going to be introducing an alternative to the bar exam to allow prospective lawyers to get their license through an interesting combination of formal education, as well as getting supervised professional experience, as well as taking a skill-based exam. What's interesting is that the commentary was that the National Conference of Bar Examiners, who realized that the bar exam as it exists today is a major profit center, I don't know how particularly supportive they are of this notion, but, you know, it was one of those things where they actually had a committee take a look at it. There was a panel that took a close look at whether something like this on a going forward basis would be workable. And after years of research on the whole phenomenon known as attorney licensure and what are the best ways to make sure that attorneys are entering the bar fully prepared to service clients, And after the results of what happened during COVID and running this experiment, the decision was that this was a go. And it's going to be interesting to see whether other states take it up. But the practical work aspect of this would include 240 hours of supervised work, of which 50 must be pro bono. And there would have to be 6 credit hours of practical work. All told, this would be about 500 hours in this particular segment. And the written exam would actually be nothing like the bar exam that we currently know, in which all of us who are lawyers here had to partake in. It would be giving this the exam takers materials and asking them to perform tasks that a typical first-year attorney would be asked to perform, with the whole idea being that practicing attorneys shouldn't have any issue passing this. Rich, I mean, I remember taking the bar over 30 years ago now, like it happened yesterday. And I think regardless of whether this particular solution takes off or not, I think that the multi-state as we know it is going to be disappearing in any event.
Yeah, I mean, I am in favor of like it. I think that the idea that you're writing this exam that has almost no relationship to what you actually do as a lawyer. I mean, to that point, like so much of what you learn in law school, I remember, you know, when we learned con law and you spent like, I don't know, the whole first year of con law learning about jurisdiction. How many times they deal with jurisdiction in actual practice? Never. So I think that and this kind of died down for a while. There was a movement for a while in law schools to be more practical and to teach more practical skills. It's died off a little, but I'm in favor of it. I mean, you know, what you write on the bar exam is like, you study for it forever and then you're done and then you don't deal with it again. Like, how many times do you come across the rule in Shelley's case in everyday practice, right? So I'm in favor of alternate licensing. I think that it makes sense. I think that if you can, it's far more important to prove that you can be a practicing lawyer and, you know, actually produce a product for your clients than some arcane legal theories that, I mean, not to say, that I don't want to do away with all of that. In this case, there was a written exam, but I'm in favor of the whole idea. Spencer, what do you think?
I love it. I hate standardized exams. Yeah. I truly hate them. Like I am, but look, I'm biased. I'm a horrible test taker, but the practicality of this is so important to me. You know, I'm a firm believer that when you're in law school, if you have the ability to work, you should work. Because, you know, for me, I started going to night school second year. First year I get not working, but second year, just the practical aspects of learning how to be a lawyer, what to be thinking about day to day, and then getting tested on that versus all the theoretical aspects. Like Rich, what you just said, like con law. I don't remember. I mean, maybe one case, the New York Times case. See, I can't remember any of these, but I had to remember them on the.
And you went to law school a lot more recent than Tina and I did.
I don't know. It was New York Times versus Sullivan. Hey, I got one. I do have one.
Yeah, case. First Amendment.
The First Amendment. Yeah. So, but beyond that, it's I think the practical nature and then putting people out there. I think people after high school should go to have to work in a pro bono manner of some sort, you know. And so, if you're doing it in law school, that's great. I think that's wonderful.
Alain, what do you think? More theory or more practical stuff?
More practical, 1,000%. Utah is my neighbor state. They are shaking things up. I love it. And I hope Idaho follows suit. The bar exam measures who's good at test taking, not who's ready to represent a client. I would certainly feel more confident as a client, an attorney having real world experience versus acing a test.
Lawyers hate taking tests. Got it.
Yes,
that's what I'm coming away with. That's what I'm coming away with in this conversation here. All right. An American who's been playing basketball professionally in Indonesia was arrested for collecting what he thought was a box of, well, I guess illegally imported cannabis gummies from his apartment. Rich, this is a pretty wild story.
Yeah, this is not Brittany Griner, of course, the athlete that we covered a lot and got a lot of international notoriety when she, of course, was locked up in Russia for many months. For trying to get vape materials through security. In this case, this is in Indonesia, who notoriously has a incredibly strict drug trafficking policy, including the death penalty. They have put something like, 500 people, Tina, of which 100 are foreigners on death row, mostly for drug-related crimes. And this individual, his name is Jared Shaw, who is an American basketball player. He was living and playing in Indonesia. He came down to his lobby, picked up a package, and it contained gummies, you know, cannabis gummies, which he thought he could use, I guess. It was for medicinal purposes, for his Crohn's disease. And he is now facing the possibility of the death penalty. And he's arguing that, you know, it's excessive, that it was for medicinal purposes, so he shouldn't be punished. Listen, at the end of the day, I feel in this way the same I did in Brittany Griner. Like, it doesn't matter what you think. Like, I could think sitting here that I have the right to murder someone. That doesn't mean I'm able to murder someone. Whatever his personal feelings are about the reason for his drugs or whether it should be sentenced in a certain way, too bad. You live in a country, learn the laws of the country you're in, abide by them, or face the consequences, right? The fact that he disagrees with them is largely irrelevant. And I feel that that's an excessive penalty for cannabis. But you know what? I'm not a legislator in that country. And those are the laws. Until they are changed, then he's got to, you know, abide by the laws.
I agree with you completely, Rich. As unfortunate a circumstance as this is, and it is understandable to us why he was using the gummies, at the end of the day, he's living in another country that has its own laws. And I would say that, you know, the public service announcement that comes out of this is, if any of our listeners ever move to another country where they're not aware of the laws regarding certain things, especially things like cannabis and drugs and things that we may be gradually permitting here, you better make sure you're fully apprised of what the rules and regs are around things like that, because those are the things that you're very likely to end up getting in trouble with.
Yeah. Glenn, you know, we all, I think, buy into the idea that every nation should adhere to a certain base, guideline of human rights, things like that. And they should, you know, not torture people. And, you know, we all believe in the Geneva Convention, things like that, right? But this is not that. This is not someone whose civil rights are being violated. This is someone who decided to bring in drugs, albeit a small amount, albeit something that in this country, in our country, would not even merit, you know, it's legal, but he's not in our country.
Exactly. As unfair as we all believe it is, I think it's, you know, heinous to potentially receive death over marijuana, what is legal in many states in the United States of America. It's a reminder, laws don't travel with you. Citizenship is not immunity. And when you cross borders, you cross legal systems too. I know there's a similar story I've been following relating to a law student in the UK, in Dubai, facing something serious. And so I think it's a reminder of being mindful of where we travel and what the laws are.
Ben, I saw the movie Midnight Express when I was a kid, probably before your time and Bellin's, but it scared me forever about any border. That was about a guy who smuggled in actual, you know, hard drugs and was thrown in a Turkish prison, and bad things happen. So it made me very cautious when I travel. Maybe this individual should have watched Midnight Express.
Exactly. He did not get the memo.
He did not get the memo that ignorance is not an excuse of the law, unfortunately.
I do want to point out that the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, which oversees most athletic, international athletic, the Olympics being one of them, it does not approve of marijuana. So, I mean, this is something that athletes, international athletes, should probably know. They do approve of CBD oil, but it's probably going to be an interesting topic coming up with the Olympics.
Even in our country, marijuana is still a controlled substance federally.
Still controlled. So, all right. ChatGPT searches and questions can apparently be used against you in court. And Tina, I want to know, I mean, is this dumb criminal stuff, this next story, or is this just kind of eye-opening as to a new way investigators can track down evidence and use evidence?
You know, Ryan, I think that's a great question. I think that, I mean, I'd love to hear what our guests say and what Rich has to say about this, because this is just a topic in general that we've been talking a lot about here on the show, about using things like ChatGPT, questions about how old you should be before you can use it, questions about just the ethics around it, I'd say. And in this case, we have a situation where a teenager vandalized 17 cars in the Missouri State University parking lot. And he was not particularly astute when he decided to spend the evening after he committed the crime asking a bunch of questions of ChatGPT about the vandalism that he committed, including asking questions about whether he could go to jail. He described in detail the kind of damage he did to the vehicles, and he wanted to see what he could potentially be held liable for. And so when the police got his phone, they were able to uncover a very detailed, transcript, essentially, of this conversation that he was having with ChatGPT. And also they were able to figure out the location of the phone as it related to the time and the location of the vandalism. And apparently at the end of the exchange, ChatGPT urged this kid to seek help, which I guess is a good thing considering some of the interviews we've had recently about some of the terrible consequences of the misuse of things like ChatGPT. But it also highlights, Ryan, to your point about, the whole seeking help thing. I mean, ultimately, was this kid just trying to do online research, or was he really reaching out to ChatGPT in a way that was almost more like a therapist or a lawyer? And really the need, I think, to educate people that you can't talk to ChatGPT. It's not a person. It's not the clergy. It's not a therapist, and it's not a lawyer. And so I think this highlights a number of different really interesting issues, Rich.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Sam Altman, mentioned that he thought, who's the OpenAI founder, of course, said that he thinks that, AI privilege should be a thing, just like doctor patient and attorney client. And of course, it should not, at least currently, given a lot of reasons. But it's just another whole long series of legal face off stories that we've covered over 10 years of really, really dumb criminals. Thank God for dumb criminals, Spencer, because they provide us with a lot of content. But yeah, it never stops to amaze me that people are searching, like, can I kill my wife using Clorox, right? and then they're shocked that the police are pounding on their door.
And I mean, what scares me at ChatGPT, what I counsel my clients about beyond the criminal aspect, is ChatGPT is a data aggregator. Like all these AIs, they aggregate data. And you need to be really careful about what you are putting in there, because it is not privileged. It's literally like the Google search aspect, right? Yeah. They collect all of this data on you. And I think you're going to see this more frequently now moving forward, where you're going to get criminals probably using these in these ways. And then the police are able to get a hold of it. And then the police are able to, as Tina, you were saying, geolocate, create a narrative, and then use it against them in court.
Well, Len, without giving up your secrets, how are you dealing with this new technology with your clients?
I remind my clients there is no attorney-client privilege with AI. If you wouldn't text it to your lawyer, if you wouldn't, if it's something that you're confessing, don't type it into ChatGPT. Every prompt you type lives on a server. Prosecutors can subpoena it, and everything you say can and will be used against you. I mean, it reminds me of the Karen Reed story when they Googled Haas long to die in cold, and it was, used against not even the defendant in this case, but it just shows you to be very careful of everything you even Google online.
Great point.
Yeah. All right. A man in India says he was instructed by divine powers to throw his shoe at the Chief Justice of India. Rich, we'll see if that flies in court.
I was going to do my best, Austin Powers. Who throws a shoe? Honestly.
I immediately went to, remember George W. Bush, yes. Remember the shoe that was thrown to him?
Yes.
Thrown at him?
The duck. Yeah.
He ducked. From our sources in India, legal face-off, Tina, we scan the globe for these stories. This is the Chief Justice of India in their Supreme Court, a lawyer who's 71, threw a shoe at the judge, right? In court number one of the Supreme Court of India. Removed his sports shoes and attempted to hurl them towards the Honorable Chief Judge. They call that they're very polite. They called it inconsistent with the dignity of the court. But then they allowed him to go and refused to press charges. I don't know if that would fly with some of the judges I appear in front of over there at the Daily Center, but they seem very nice about this shoe incident.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, believe it or not, I actually do a lot of enforcement, IP enforcement in India. So I actually know more than the average lawyer about the courts and, you know, tribunals over in India. And I, you know, was a little bit shocked by this. I mean, maybe at the end of the day, they figured this guy has some serious issues and that's why they let him go, because I don't see this type of behavior flying in any court, particularly in India court.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Spencer, ever throw any part of your footwear at anyone in authority?
I've always wanted to. I'll tell a lot of my colleagues when I get frustrated, I don't want to throw a shoe at them because I think about the George Bush incident. But I've not had the pleasure yet of throwing one of my shoes at a judge because, yeah, I don't think it would go over as well as it did there. So,
Glenn, you're in Idaho. You know, the rules are a little different. I know it's the Wild West. What's happening there in courts in Idaho?
I mean, certainly if you throw a shoe at the judge, not only are you throwing away your career, but you would be promptly arrested. I will say from a defense standpoint, we often use mitigation. And the fact that he's 71 years old does, you know, bring compassion. Perhaps there was some mental issues going on. He said divine sources were speaking to him. I believe the court did show restraint here. I believe suspension is enough punishment for this gentleman.
If you throw your shoe, then you've got nothing but a sock left, too. I mean, it's just not a lot of forward thinking when you throw your shoe, because then what do? You got to go pick up your shoe. I mean, are you going to be, are you just going to go one shoe for the rest of the day to make your point? I mean,
that's a good point.
Exactly.
Right? It's an excellent question. We're going to end off in a second, but I want to ask Ryan Burrow, since you raised that issue, do you go sock, shoe? Or do you go sock, shoe?
Yeah, so I don't put one sock and then a shoe on and then another sock and a shoe on. You go sock, shoe. Now, I go left sock first, then right sock.
Left sock, right sock. Wow.
Left sock, I do that, yeah.
I do right and left, and I'm wondering if that's because I'm a lefty.
Yeah. There's an old All in the Family bit about that very question. About it's more about whether you tie the shoe first, put on the shoe, tie it, or put on both shoes and then tie both. It's Ed, Michael Stivic, and Archie are discussing this. But I digress. We're going to finish off our legal face-off, our grab bag, Spencer and Belen, with a question that we're surprising you with. You have no time to prepare to learn a little bit about you from a story that we cover today. It's everyone's least favorite segment of legal grab bag. We talked about Nirvana, of course, the album, and, you know, we talked about the 90s, how old this case was. How about, what's one relic of the 90s, Belen, even though this is before your time, that you would like to bring back, much like the album that generated Smells Like Teen Spirit? Never mind. What's one thing from the 90s that you'd like to bring back in today's society?
I'm so happy you asked this question. I was just speaking to my sister and my husband about the T-Mobile Sidekick. It was right before my parents allowed me to get a cell phone, and I had been planning the T-Mobile Sidekick. You know, you just flip it out, and then they just continued it. So I have been Googling and finding T-Mobile Sidekicks on eBay and debating purchasing it just, you know, to have as memorabilia and bedazzle it.
That Sidekick was a status symbol, man. If you had that Sidekick, you were balling for sure. Spencer, that was a great one, by the way. And unprepared, that's amazing. Spencer,
visors. From the 90s. Visors. Like, you know, the visors with like the open top, and then like you could, then they would like tilt it to the side.
Oh, hell
with,
yeah.
Like the baggy pants. I mean, that was style back then.
Were you a punk guy? Did you ever skateboarder?
I'm not going to comment one way or the other, but I did have that visor to the side in the Oakleys. Let's
go
with
baggy jeans.
Yeah, let's go with that. It was the middle school days for me. So
there you go.
That's awesome. Ryan Burrow, the 90s.
I remember them fondly. I wish we were back in the days when the Bulls were good and Michael Jordan was here dominating in Chicago. Just if we could put that in a bottle and release it every now and again, I'd love to do that.
That's a good one, Jordan and the Bulls. Tina, something from the 90s that you would love to bring back in the 2020s.
The Macarena.
Mmm.
Goodness.
For IP reasons.
Goodness.
But Macarena was great.
Go watch Hillary Clinton do it at the DNC.
Yes. Can you name the bag? Can you name the the musicians, Los Something Boys, wasn't it? Yeah, it was
I am drawing a blank.
Lisa, what do you got?
I love Super Mario, the Mario games.
Mm. Still popular.
Los Del Rio.
Los Del Rio. I was
1993.
Like, I was a third of the way there. So, you know, we have an old rule that you can't repeat something that someone said, but Burrow inadvertently stepped on mine earlier. I was going to say Columbia House Record Club. That is how I built my record collection, my DVD collection. Hundreds and hundreds of fraudulently obtained pieces of musical recordings under the many, many names I would use for Columbia House. I think the statute of limitations has far passed. I can now admit that I would send in that thing with a penny. Back in the day, by the way, you would actually tape a penny, Tina remembers, to the applications in, and magically, like 10 records would appear, another two for like $2 each, and then you just do it all over again with a fake name. It was amazing. But because Burrow mentioned it, I'm going to go with the precursor to texting, AOL Instant Messenger. Remember that? They just did away with it. Last week was that AOL finally, the last sound of that. Remember?
Rest in peace, AOL Messenger.
Disk in the mail and stick it in your computer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You go and you pick up all those like freebie ones, you know, you'd see it like at a convenience store or something. You'd grab it so you can get 10 hours of free AOL or something. So.
Let's see the other end of that tail. Where's that beast that's been walking by? Let's
bring it. Yeah. Come here. No, she's sunbathing behind me right now.
Rich, I've seen a dog flash by in your frame in the back.
That's what I saw too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I got a couple here today. Ziggy and his friend Ray.
Glenn, you a big animal person? What do you got? Horses, maybe, in Idaho?
I have chickens. I have a turkey. I have ducks. I have a dog.
They yours, or they just randomly walk through your yard?
No, they're ours. Okay. I live in the country. I'm a country gal.
Do you get concerned? Are there coyotes that come after the chickens? Because that would be a problem here.
Yes, one unfortunately took our newest little baby chick.
Oh, no.
So we bought the turkey to protect the chickens, and it's actually done a great job. She attacked my dog. I have a Pomeranian, so we have to train the dog to, you know, kind of keep her distance. So
the turkey protects the chickens.
Yes.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yes.
Fantastic.
We built them a little chicken coop. I painted it pink.
Does it have your sign above? Yeah.
It doesn't. It has my children's name, Santiago and Valentin's chicken coop, but I painted the inside pink. We kept the outside to match my home. So it's an aesthetic, you know, gray neutral color, very boring, but the inside is pink.
That's fantastic. Do you get egg a day or from the chickens?
Yes, we just actually, they probably won't lay until the spring because we just had them in April. And so I unfortunately learned we won't be able to have farm fresh eggs until next year.
Oh, that's fantastic. So,
you'd like me to send some eggs to Chicago? I can.
let's wrap this up. Thank you so much, attorney and farmer Belen Myers and Spencer Pollock. And that'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face Off. Special thanks to attorney. What's that? Cubs in five? You're okay. We'll see what happens here. Special thanks to attorney Matthew Bergman, founder of Social Media Victims Law Center, Leon Rodriguez, partner with SafeArth, and Patrick Krill of Krill Strategies. Also, shout out to Ben Anderson, Lisa Stegall. For Tina Martini, Rich Lenkov, I'm Brian Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Faceoff on WGN. Cubs in five.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkov. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Faceoff. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget.